Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Abbey. My name is Ellen Clark King. I'm the Dean of King's College London. And it's my great pleasure to welcome all of you to this year's Eric Symes Abbott Lecture, established in 1986 to honour one of my great predecessors, the very Reverend Eric Symes Abbott, and to continue his interest in spirituality and pastoral theology very widely interpreted. And it's my especial pleasure and honour to welcome this year's speaker, Lord Adonis. We're delighted to have you here to speak on a topic that could not be more heartbreakingly timely, securing a Europe of peace, freedom, and justice. Lord Adonis brings to this subject a wealth of experience in journalism and in politics. Born in London, of British and Cypriot descent, he read modern history at Keble and was made a Fellow of Nuffield College after completing his DPhil at Christchurch. His career in journalism saw him work for the Financial Times and The Observer, and more recently, The New European. In politics, he was a member and then head of the No. 10 policy unit, created Baron Adonis in 2005, and held posts as a Labour cabinet minister and transport secretary. He's been involved in education and in academies for many years and was appointed a visiting professor at King's in 2015. Lord Adonis was one of the clearest voices opposing Brexit and has said that taking us back into Europe will become the mission of our children's generation. He also said in a powerful recent speech in the Lords that we are all Ukrainians today. I don't want to take any more of the time that could be more profitably used listening to the man himself. So, Lord Adonis, please speak to us about peace, freedom, and justice in a Europe grievously afflicted with war. And will you join me in welcoming him?
Ellen, thank you very much indeed for that very kind introduction. I can scarcely believe I'm speaking in this august venue, or indeed that we're present here, and it'll be one of the highlights of my life, speaking not only before such a distinguished audience, but before a collection of deans. And I asked the Dean of Westminster before what was the collective noun for deans, and there was no agreement between the two deans as to whether it was a decanter or a forest. So I leave you to make your choice. But it is a huge privilege to deliver this Eric Abbott Memorial Lecture in the presence of the Dean of King's College London and the Dean of Westminster in this sacred and historic place. I'm privileged to have a connection with all three of the institutions which are associated with Eric Abbott's illustrious career. As Ellen said, as a visiting professor of King's College London, a graduate and honorary fellow of Keble College, Oxford. My connection with Westminster Abbey is at once more indirect, but more personal to Eric Abbott. One of my former researchers is a grandson of Eric Abbott's successor, but two, as Dean of Westminster, Michael Main. And he tells me that Abbott's reputation was very much like that of John Keble, in whose memory Keble College was founded. He was a profoundly gentle and spiritual pastor who commanded respect and transformed lives by the simplicity of his character, the extent and depth of his concern for others, and the profundity of his faith. He was unmarried, and the church and its priests and parishioners were his life. Eric Abbott was a man of institutions. Churchill said of the reconstruction of the chamber of the House of Commons, bombed only a few hundred yards from here by Hitler's Luftwaffe, "We shape our institutions and they shape us." Maybe the only institutions to have shaped us, the English, more, or at least as much as, the House of Commons are Westminster Abbey, this royal throne of kings, and the University of Oxford, including Keble College, which, as Roy Jenkins used to point out to me in his meticulous statistical way, is almost exactly midway in the order of creation of its colleges, and which, like King's College London, was founded to glorify and advance the Church of England in the Victorian era. No one understood and worked England's institutions better than Eric Abbott. As well as serving as Dean of this cathedral, he was Warden of Keble College, Dean of King's College London, and the first chaplain to Her Majesty the Queen in 1952. And no one understood better the imperative for institutions to be self-critical. In the fourth of his Meditations on the Mystery of the Transfiguration, delivered in this cathedral in the midst of the bombing and bloodshed of the Second World War, he makes this profound remark. The death of our Lord accomplished at Jerusalem means that probably the real enemies are within our gates. We tend to think that the chief sufferings are those inflicted by the world upon the church, but those sufferings are easy to bear compared with the sufferings which we bear as Christians within the church. These come because the church is the place where the tensions of life have to be resolved at the deepest level, and peace comes at an extreme cost. Those words of Eric Abbott, "peace only comes at an extreme cost," are the text of my lecture. Peace comes at extreme costs not only in the church, but in all human enterprises. The enterprise I particularly wish to discuss with you this evening is Europe, where peace has come and still comes today at the extreme cost of virtually constant war and civil war since Europe's very inception as a recognizable entity in the Middle Ages, the age when this great, shortly after this great cathedral was founded. The task of our generation is to forge a new and better peace, and for that we will have to pay an extreme cost, not only in averting wars, but in reforming Europe's institutions so that they are fit for promoting peace in the next generation. For Europe's wars are not remotely over. In an insight as profound as Eric Abbott's, former Chancellor Angela Merkel used to remark that the Peace of Augsburg, the great treaty of 1555 for perpetual peace across the lands of Germany, Austria, and beyond, between the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V and the Schmalkaldic League, and which allowed the princes of Europe to select either Protestantism or Catholicism as the religion of their domains and granted free emigration of residents who dissented, that this peace came only 64 years before the outbreak of the 30 Years' War, a European civil war as terrible and bloody as the 30 Years' War of the 20th century between the outbreak of the First World War in Sarajevo in 1914 and the conclusion of the Second World War after the Holocaust and almost total destruction of Germany and much of Europe in 1945. It is a poignant reflection that it was precisely 64 years, the same interval as between the Peace of Augsburg and the outbreak of the 30 Years' War, that this precise 64-year interval lay between the inauguration of the European Union in 1958 and the outbreak of the Ukraine War this February. In Ukraine, the peace of Europe is vitiated on a scale not seen since 1945, and the unspeakable horrors of the 30 Years' War and both world wars of the 20th century are being repeated by the latest of our continent's tyrants, Vladimir Putin, in the siege of Mariupol, the extermination in Bucha, and the whole vicious, unsparing attack on the territory, integrity, and democracy of Ukraine by Russia. Furthermore, like all wars in Europe over ages past, the Ukraine war is in fundamental respects a civil war between peoples whose bonds are as significant as their differences, two peoples, Russian and Ukrainian, who share not only a largely common history and culture, but also a common Orthodox Church, the Russian Orthodox Church, whose spiritual home was in Kiev until the acrimonious split of the Orthodox Church in the run-up to this war, an event which goes to the heart of Eric Abbott's observation that the church is the place where the tensions of life have to be resolved at the deepest level. The Russian Orthodox Patriarch Kirill has been blessing Vladimir Putin's war against Ukraine, which I believe will go down as one of the darkest chapters in the history of Christendom, akin to the quarter of the Lutheran clergy, who were members of the Nazi Party in 1933, and the dealings of Pope Leo XII with Europe's fascist dictators in the same decade. It reminds me, in a way, of one of those lines of Orwell as the Luftwaffe bombed London in 1940. As I write, civilized human beings are flying overhead trying to kill me. They do not feel any enmity against me as an individual, nor I against them. They are only doing their duty, serving their country, which has the power to absolve them from evil. The Ukrainian war is also a civil war in a wider European context. If we, as I think we should, regard Russia as a power and a people destined one day, under enlightened leadership, to take their place among the great peoples, nations, and democracies of Europe, to which Russia is not only geographically contiguous, but in fundamental ways, social, religious, and political, co-sanguineous. So I take my cue this evening from Eric Abbott. Peace only comes at extreme cost, and the institutions of peace need to be built painfully anew in each generation. In Europe today, we have three fundamental institutions of peace: the European Union, the Council of Europe, and NATO. And I want to suggest that all three need to be significantly strengthened in the immediate future if the peace of Europe is to be advanced. All three of these modern institutions of peace in Europe were established in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War in a bid to ensure that nothing like it ever happened again. The Council of Europe was established in 1948. Its first chairman was Winston Churchill, to enshrine the principles of human rights that underpinned the Nuremberg trial of the Nazi regime's leaders 2 years earlier, and which were thereafter set out in the European Convention on Human Rights and given teeth in the establishment as part of the Council of the European Court of Human Rights. I'm privileged to be one of the UK parliamentary members of the Council of Europe, and it is a somber reflection on the state of Europe that our principal business meeting in Strasbourg last month was to expel Russia from membership of the Council. In the centre of our movement stands the idea of a charter of human rights guarded by freedom and sustained by law, said Churchill at the first meeting of the Council of Europe in 1948. In today's Russia, there is neither freedom nor the rule of law. The second of the great post-war European institutions, the European Union, began as a project for Franco-German economic partnership in the Schuman Plan, leading to the European Coal and Steel Community of 1951, expanded into a comprehensive economic partnership between the continent's leading democracies in the Treaty of Rome 6 years later. With the fall of dictatorships first in southern Europe in the 1970s, then in Central and Eastern Europe after 1989, the EU expanded to become a confederation of 28 nations, now, alas, 27 with the departure of Britain, making it a union of free peoples with no parallel in history except the United States of America. For those who mistake its purpose, never forget that Churchill, who called for the establishment of what became the EU in his great Zurich speech of 1946, said that the imperative was to build a kind of United States of Europe. And that is indeed what has been accomplished since 1951, a project which Britain must, I believe, return in due course when we come once again to realise, as we did in the generation after the war, that peace only comes at extreme cost, including a necessary cost to prejudices of narrow nationalism, including English nationalism. The third of the great post-war institutions of peace, NATO, is the greatest defensive alliance that the peace-abiding nations of Europe have ever constructed against external aggressors. There was nothing inevitable after 1945 about NATO's bedrock of a defensive military partnership between the United States of America and most of the states of what became the European Union. On the contrary, in 1945, Roosevelt and Truman declared that the United States would withdraw all troops from Europe within 2 years, and indeed tried to broker a neutral and demilitarized Germany as the price of a peace with Russia in the immediate aftermath of the war, an outcome which was only narrowly averted by Ernest Bevin and Clement Attlee leading the new Labour government after 1945. It was the visionary leadership of Bevin who persuaded the equally tough-minded Secretary of State George Marshall of the United States in 1947 that Stalin was in all essentials another Hitler and had to be resisted in the same way if the peace of Western Europe was to be preserved. It was this which led to the creation of NATO 2 years later in the aftermath of the successful raising of the siege of Berlin after a year-long airlift, which came perilously close to seeing Stalin colonize the whole of Germany, west as well as east, and from there to seek to subjugate most of Western Europe, possibly instigating a Third World War only 3 years after the second. 73 years later, NATO has a membership of 30 nations, soon to become 32 as Finland and Sweden join rapidly in direct response to Putin's invasion of Ukraine. And whereas the UK has regrettably left the EU, it is a stalwart of NATO and has played a vital leadership role in bolstering Ukraine's defence against Putin's invasion. Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty of 1949, that an attack on one member of NATO is an attack on all, is a fundamental recognition that peace only comes at extreme cost. It is important to appreciate how radical these three institutions, the EU, the Council of Europe, and NATO, were when they were set up. Pre-war Europe not only lacked such supranational institutions, it lacked the very basis for them in that few of Europe's nations were genuine democracies respecting human rights, including freedom of religion, and governed by the free will of free peoples expressed through free multi-party elections. Indeed, the number of democracies declined dramatically in the 1930s as fascist and communist coups felled the democratic regimes of most continental states. There is nothing inevitable in the rise and persistence of democracy in Europe, and we take it for granted at our peril. Several of the most powerful books about politics in the recent years have had titles like How Democracies Die and How Democracies Fail, and the number of democracies is rapidly declining worldwide at the moment. Before 1939, there were no European institutions to slow, let alone to halt, the descent into fascism and communism, nor were there in the mid-1940s, when Stalin seized control in a succession of coups of most of Central and Eastern Europe. Even those states like Czechoslovakia and Poland, which did have the semblance of free elections in the immediate aftermath of the war. Nor was Europe much stronger in the realm of ideas. Britain, maybe Europe's most influential political philosopher, Thomas Hobbes, described life as nasty, brutish, and short, reflecting on his writing during the English Civil War, and pronounced it as axiomatic that power without the sword is mere words. Thomas Aquinas, maybe Europe's most celebrated Christian theologian, legitimized war, and for all my childhood love of C.S. Lewis and Narnia, they were eclipsed by Lord of the Rings, by his fellow Oxonian Tolkien, which is a tale of war and degeneracy straight out of the trenches of the Somme and the beaches of Gallipoli. Mordor was Treblinka and Auschwitz 2 generations ago. It was Mostar and Sarajevo 1 generation ago. It is Mariupol and Bucha today. And Archbishop Kirill is there with the cross and mitre of the Russian Orthodox Church. It is a well-proven truth that democracies are far less likely to fight each other than autocracies. And the current concurrent growth of democracy and supranationalism in Europe is the basis for the modern peace which reigns over most of our continent, but by no means all of it. The two go together subtract democracy, and NATO could easily become an aggressive, expansionary military organisation. Subtract democracy, and the EU becomes a trade bloc without values of inclusion and peaceful coexistence. And subtract democracy, and there is nothing whatever left of the European Convention on Human Rights, which is the reason why Russia, after the invasion of Ukraine and the imprisonment of its opposition leader, Navalny, could not conceivably remain a member of the Council of Europe. Ukraine starkly exposes the roots of European peace as shallow and easily washed away by dictators and resurgent populist nationalism. We in Britain should be all too conscious of this, for while a long tradition of representative government has for centuries been a glory of England, celebrated at the coronation of each monarch in the oaths that the monarch takes to observe the revolution settlement of the 17th century and the constitution developed since. Britain reached democracy proper less than a century ago and coexisted until a generation ago with imperialism abroad and imperialism even within the British Isles of the most ugly sectarian form in Ireland. British imperialism in Ireland continued until a century ago this year, when Southern Ireland became independent, after the experience of a famine, when, as Sir Charles Russell, the permanent secretary of the Irish office, put it in words of unspeakable callousness, the Irish were left, and I quote, to the operation of natural causes, something that would have been inconceivable on the part of a British government in the 19th century in respect of England. Thereafter, the growing clamour for Irish self-government was resisted, first politically and then militarily, for a further 70 years, again with unspeakable atrocities being committed on both sides, until a century ago this year, when Southern Ireland finally attained self-government. And British imperialism in Northern Ireland persisted until the 1990s in the North, when the Belfast Good Friday Agreement at last brought peace, and the role of UK government as honest broker was established rather than as a partisan across the sectarian divide, which had been the case before. The role of the United Kingdom government as a peace-promoting honest broker is once again in question today after the Northern Ireland elections last week and amid a stark debate within Her Majesty's government about ripping up the Northern Ireland Protocol to favour just one sectarian party in Northern Ireland. It is to be hoped that all parties, including our own government, will pay the price of peace and ensure that Ireland as a whole, North and South, continues with a completely open and unimpeded border to goods, trade and people, which is the bedrock of the Good Friday Agreement. But taking steps to maintain what we already have in terms of democracy and prosperity is a small price to pay for peace. The larger costs and sacrifices lie in building up the European Union, the Council of Europe and NATO as far stronger institutions, better able to resist enemies within as well as without, to use Eric Abbott's image of Jerusalem, and for the churches and religions of Europe to do the same in their own communions and interfaith partnerships. The French people have thankfully just resoundingly defeated parties claiming that Europe was subject to a malign great replacement of Christian with Islamic peoples and culture. And religious leaders need to preach unity, not division, and enshrine it in institutions as much as political leaders are duty-bound to do so. Is it too fanciful to think of a European Union of churches and religions alongside the political and economic institutions of the European Union itself? Should the Church of England not be wholly more ambitious than thinking in terms of common purposes amongst the Anglican Communion and turn interfaith and interdenominational partnership into concrete institutions? I can hardly think of a greater and more positive Christian project for the next generation or institutions better able to take a lead than Westminster Abbey and the Church of England. We also need to take to heart those words of Churchill: in the centre of our European movement stands the idea of a Charter of Human Rights guarded by freedom and sustained by law. Freedom and law. Most of the meetings of the Council of Europe which I attend are depressing recitals of a lack of freedom and breaches of law across Europe. Turkey is a member of the Council of Europe, yet has tens of thousands of political prisoners and hundreds of journalists also in jail. The European Court of Human Rights has only a fraction of the resources to deal with the deluge of cases which are lodged each year in respect of Europe's authoritarian and only quasi-democratic states. And it is surely time for minimum standards of democracy, freedom and judicial independence to be laid down for membership of both the European Union and the Council of Europe. Hungary, at present, is blocking all further EU sanctions against Russia. This is clearly unacceptable. And Europe's democracies cannot themselves remain static and ossified. As Thomas Dewey rightly observed a century ago, the cure for the problems of democracy is more democracy. The leading edge practice of democracy today is about empowering the young, votes at 16, and far more young people elected to parliaments and assemblies, devolving power locally and ensuring diversity at the heart of all democratic institutions. This needs to become the standard practice of all Europe's democracies, including here in England. Greater equality with a renewed mission to end poverty are equally critical. Within England, there is a 7-year life expectancy gap between richer and poorer areas. If the poor, meaning those on subsistence wages or lower, of this great city of London were all housed in a single place, they would become the second largest city in England, larger even than Birmingham. A third of children in England today grow up in relative poverty, a far higher proportion than a generation ago. And poverty and subsistence wages have become the driver of extreme nationalist and populist politics across Europe. Peace only comes at extreme cost, and the richer regions and nations of our continent need to do far more in the next generation than the last to maintain it internally as well as externally. The European Union has long realised that in principle, alongside a single currency, needs to come far greater redistributionist policies, and these are now taking shape in the wake of the COVID pandemic. They are as important to the sustainability of Europe as the extreme cost which needs to be borne to secure energy independence and a sustainable low-carbon future, about which we talk far more. The price of peace also comes in a readiness to defend our values with hard and soft power. The soft power of cultural partnerships and externally facing institutions which champion our democracy and freedom has never been more important than it is today. Maybe the greatest thing the United Kingdom does for European values is the huge inflow of international students to our universities, including the universities of Oxford and London. The impact of Brexit is drastically reducing student inflows to Britain from the rest of Europe, and this is a serious retrograde step. Maybe our next greatest instrument of soft power is the BBC, which has demonstrated its world-class reputation for fearless, objective reporting in Ukraine and should be expanded, not contracted, as an instrument of peace. But we cannot shirk the imperative to boost hard power as well as soft power. And NATO needs every bit as much enhancement as our universities and our cultural institutions. By enhancement, I mean not only a willingness of European nations to spend more on defence, on which Germany is now taking a lead alongside France and Germany. I mean boosting NATO as an organisation of democracies which preaches self-defence as the means to promote European and democratic values, not least in the partnership work of the US and Europe's armed forces with those in other countries, including in peacekeeping and in nation building, which are so important a part of the work of modern armed forces. When writing the biography of Ernest Bevin, the British Foreign Secretary who forged NATO in 1949, I was struck by his insistence that NATO should be an organisation, not just a defensive alliance, hence the O in NATO. That's why there is a NATO Parliamentary Assembly and a whole set of NATO youth and cultural institutions, all of which need to be strengthened alongside the hard power of defensive hardware and personnel. And this is a particular role for Britain as not only a leading NATO member, but as a close, maybe the closest of Europe's strategic partners with the United States. The work of the Council of Europe has also become more important to Britain for this same reason, and it should be boosted, including far greater support for international human rights and development. In these respects, it is vital to see the Ukraine war as an extreme version of persisting war and conflict within Europe, not just an entirely new manifestation of this evil. Indeed, by comparison with Slobodan Milosevic and Serbia's atrocities in Bosnia and Kosovo only 30 years ago, Putin and the atrocities in Ukraine are not particularly extreme, just a question of larger countries and more powerful dictators doing the same horrendous things. Ukraine is Russia's third European invasion of the last 14 years. Before it came the invasion of Georgia in 2008 and Crimea 6 years later. War, civil war, and Cold War still persist between Azerbaijan, Georgia, and Armenia, all three of them European nations and members of the Council of Europe. The meeting of the Council of Europe before last was taken, virtually the whole of the plenary sessions were taken in ferocious arguments between delegates from those three countries about ongoing wars and the aftermath of wars. And a Cold War persists between Turkey and Cyprus over my still divided native island. And both of those nations, Turkey and Cyprus too, are members of the Council of Europe, and I can assure you there are free and frank exchanges of views between those nations when the Council meets. We here in Britain think of the European Court of Human Rights in terms of relatively minor issues of government overreach. In respect of Eastern, Central, and Southern Europe, it debates matters of war and peace, life and death. And until the existing boundaries of Europe become a comprehensive zone of peace, stability, and prosperity, instability across these boundaries will continue to be endemic, even without dictators like Putin. This is not yet remotely close to happening 2 generations after the Second World War. In a path-breaking speech earlier this week, President Macron of France took as his theme the imperative for closer cooperation focused on shared tasks and called for a new European political community extending to European nations outside the European Union, including Britain and Ukraine, a symbolic partnership if ever there was one. Such a new political community would, as he put it, allow democratic European nations to find a new space for political cooperation and security cooperation in energy, transport, investment, infrastructure, and the movement of people. The case for such a European political community as an instrument of partnership and confidence building across our continent seems to me unanswerable in the context of Brexit and the challenges of the future, not least the aftermath of the Ukraine war. And I hope it receives a warm response from our government. We have been paying the extreme cost of defending peace in the military conflict in Ukraine. Structured and systematic political and strategic cooperation is a small additional price to pay. Indeed, it is hardly a price, but a recognition of self-interest and mutual interdependence. But in this place, in this great abbey, and at this time of European strife, I don't hesitate in conclusion to return to Eric Abbott's injunction that, as with Christ's death in Jerusalem, probably the real enemies are within our gates. I don't myself engage in much religious politics. I don't have the tough armour to be able to do so. But in preparing for this lecture, I looked at what institutions there are for European interfaith and interdenominational cooperation, and they are distinctly lacking. Surely there should be a debate on new institutions which are the religious equivalent of the Council of Europe, focused on conflict resolution and the advancement of religion, human and religious rights across our religious communities. It would be great to hear from the leaders of this abbey and this church on what radical departures might be taken. For if peace only comes at an extreme cost, those most devoted to peace should be the first and foremost prepared to pay it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lord Adonis. That was terrific. No prizes for guessing that I'm the other dean. I'm the dean of Westminster. The outfit's a bit of a giveaway. If I stand still with my mouth open, people post letters in me. We are delighted to have you here this evening. Lord Adonis has kindly agreed to take questions. It would help me and all of us if you keep your questions fairly brief, please, because I think I may occasionally have to relay them. In fact, I don't think we've got a microphone in the Abbey, so I think I may be having to come a bit nearer to you to hear the question and then repeat it. So if you have a question, could you please, thank you, an arm's gone up.
It's obviously an acute cause of concern, but equally, Ukraine is a European nation, and the first and foremost responsibility for resolving the Ukraine crisis and preventing aggression from triumphing must lie with the European powers. And of course, the judgment of Putin in invading Ukraine had nothing whatsoever to do with nations outside Europe. It was a judgment that Europe itself would not pull together and act decisively. That was why he thought he could take over the whole country, suborn the government, and replace it with a puppet regime within 48 hours. He proved unable to do that because of the resilience of Ukraine, backed strongly by immediate European sanctions and substantial military support. The tale, I look forward to all the books that are going to be written by the Max Hastings of the Ukraine war about the degree of military support that was being given in the run-up to the invasion and in those opening days, but it will clearly turn out to have been of huge consequence. So the prime responsibility for ensuring that Putin did not triumph in Ukraine lay with Europe. And I think it's fair to say that Europe, with its ally, the United States, have risen to the challenge. And it could be that we are about to see one of the great military turnarounds of history. Indeed, Putin's military objectives, of course, have not been met because of his failure to defeat Ukraine and remove President Zelensky within the first few days. But it may be that there is an abject failure even to take over large parts of the east of the country. It would be great if we had an alliance for democracy with countries like India and Indonesia. But Europe has to lead by example, and the stronger that the democracies of Europe are and the European Union are after this catastrophe of the Ukraine war, the more likely the Indias, the Modis, and the Indonesias are to move in our direction rather than in the direction of the dictators of China and Russia.
Thank you. Thank you, Lord Andonis. My question to you was, would you consider the expansion of the work of the World Council of Churches in bringing different faiths together? Certainly, the Society of Friends does a lot of work with the United Nations. Or would you think it best that there should be a new development that is more inclusive?
The World Council of Churches clearly does enormously valuable work, but in respect of Europe, as important as cooperation between churches and denominations is structured cooperation between religions, and that at the moment is in a very embryonic state, in a much more embryonic state in religious terms than economic and political partnership is between the nations of Europe, I would suggest, from my reading of the situation. I spent the French election substantially in Paris. I was amazed by the viciousness and raw xenophobia and mutual incomprehension and hatred between the two sides of the French election, and the Zemmour and the manifesto of the extreme right which polled nearly 10% of the vote directly and probably had substantial support from another 20 to 25% of the French electorate, was exhibited a degree of hatred between religious communities in France of a kind which we in England simply don't experience, but which is an absolute hallmark of French public and private life, and that of a large part of continental Europe too. There are no institutions in France which bridge the divide. There are none which bridge the religious divide. President Macron is seeking to lead a party with some success, which bridges the political divide. But until that religious divide is bridged, I think the future of Europe is going to be perilous. And it seemed to me, in thinking about the remarks I'd make to you this evening, that a call to the religious communities, well beyond the Christian communities, to heal the divide is hugely important. It's also the case, of course, as one who's a dutiful member of the Church of England, that relations between the Protestant churches and the Roman Catholic Church are still very embryonic. It was only a generation ago, 20 years after the formation of the European Union, that there was a first meeting between the Archbishop of Canterbury and a reigning pope. That is extraordinary when you think about it, and it is still regarded as a great event when such meetings take place. Well, I'm glad to say that even Boris Johnson had a telephone call with President Macron a few days ago, and he doesn't hesitate to speak to other European leaders. It would be great if His Holiness the Pope and the leaders of the other Christian denominations of Europe, including those Orthodox leaders who I mentioned in my remarks, spoke as frequently as the political leaders of Europe and sought to develop a dialogue which was as interactive as they do. And too doesn't happen at the moment. I personally, speaking very personally, was extremely disturbed by the remarks of the Pope a few days ago about the relative apportionment of blame between Russia and Ukraine in the invasion that took place, which looked to me to be a straightforward splitting of the difference between the Russian Orthodox Church and West European churches from a leader from South America. And I say that slightly controversially, but the churches of Europe have not been in any way instruments of resolving the Ukraine crisis. On the contrary, alas, in the division of the Orthodox Church, they were very important forces pushing both nations towards division, and were both manipulated, particularly in the case of the Russian Orthodox Church, of course, by President Putin. Alas.
I mean, the business of the relationship between nationalism and religion in Europe is clearly extremely complex. I wonder if I could tempt you to speculate. Is there ever a good form of nationalism? Can you imagine a positive kind of nationalism that can intrinsically reach across boundaries? Or do we need to be in the business of actually being rather more binary about what nationalism is and is capable of?
Well, the short answer is, of course, all forms of association which are peaceful and friendly and stimulate mutual obligation are worthwhile. Families, communities, neighbourhoods, those little platoons which Edmund Burke said are the bedrock of well-functioning societies, and of course that rises to nations too. Where, of course, nationalism becomes a positive evil is when it stimulates xenophobia and hatred and conflict between nations. And there is clearly good nationalism which celebrates diversity and achievement and bonds of association. And there is a bad form of nationalism which harnesses that for enmity and evil. And the job of wise political leaders, and I would suggest wise religious leaders, is to understand the difference between those two and to ensure that nationalism stays on the positive and not the negative side of that divide. And it looks to me, as a general rule, when you look across Europe, that where you have political leaders who celebrate diversity and mutual association, religious leaders in those same countries tend to follow. Where you have political leaders who don't, religious leaders not only don't follow, but they are often more extreme than those political leaders because they become positive religious ideologues for division. And in the case of some European countries, of course, those forces are taking place within the countries as well as between them. So it's a very sobering reflection, I think, for those of us who are engaged in religious affairs to see how we can be agents of a positive and constructive form of nationalism and not like, alas, the leaders of the Russian Orthodox Church today, the leaders of division and hatred between peoples who were, until very recently, regarded themselves as brothers and sisters in a similar religious and political community.
I come from one of your former colonies, and we recently had a president, he who shall not be named, who was very anxious to break ties with NATO and with other European institutions. And there is a fear that he might return. I guess there's even a play on in London called 47, where he returns. And I'm sure if he does, he would want to pull out of NATO as he had threatened to do before. How essential do you think is the United States in maintaining this sort of institutions that you're talking about?
Utterly essential, utterly, until Europe is prepared to pay properly for the cost of its own defense, which it hasn't been for the last two generations and still isn't today. But it's not only in terms of Europe's own defense, which of course is critically important, but our wider strategic interests in other parts of the globe are utterly dependent on the alliance with the United States. So I hope that the eventuality you've just discussed doesn't come to pass.
Well, thank you. I actually had a very similar question. I wanted to expand on that. How do you see the United States, which now is sort of, in present day, is not really considered Europe as much as it was during the World Wars, in what way you perhaps see it's playing a role in the future, not just in political like unification, but in what you suggested, like religious action internationally, promoting a and securing a peaceful Europe?
Well, I think one of the byproducts of the Ukraine war is it's brought home to the American public and the American political community that the frontier of Europe is also the frontier of the United States. Russian cyber war has been every bit as intense in the United States as it has across Europe, and equally destructive. And the recognition of this is now profound in Washington. So, which links with the previous question, I don't actually think, even if 47 were to go in the way that you fear, that the United States would withdraw from NATO or weaken its commitment. I think the strategic interests of the United States against dictators, of whom the foremost are Putin and President Xi of China, are so profound that our boundary and our frontier is their frontier, and I don't think that that will change simply with a change of president of the United States. And it's very important that we do see our interests as joint, because part of the reason why Putin acted as he did, and I hope we can confidently say in due course he miscalculated, was because he believed that we would be divided and not united. And it's hard for democracies to show unity because, of course, they each have to undergo an internal process of democratic decision-making. But I think the unity of Europe and the United States in the face of Putin has been much, much stronger than anybody envisaged, and it has come from a profound realization that defeat in Ukraine at the hands of Putin would represent an existential threat to our whole strategic security and freedom in the future.
President Macron's suggestion of a new European body to enhance our cooperation on security and all other mutual issues beyond the European Union sounds welcome. But to what extent is it actually necessary in that we already have the Council of Europe and indeed the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe? Could not those bodies, if enhanced and given more in the way that you've suggested, fulfil that role already?
Well, the problem with both of those bodies is that they don't involve regular meetings of heads of government. And it's meetings of heads of government that are so important. And to my mind, one of the most profound regrets of Brexit is that Britain and its head of government is no longer around the council table of the Council of Europe, which is utterly critical to all of the strategic decisions, not only taken by the European Union, but at a broader strategic level by Europe as a whole. It's been very notable that in the key turning points of the Ukraine war, Britain has in fact been around the table. Foreign Secretary Truss was at a meeting of the European Foreign Affairs Council, and though Boris Johnson, because of a falling out between him and President Macron, didn't attend the subsequent European Council, I forget which particular insult he hurled at our European partners at the time. They had come so thick and fast it's hard to remember which one was which. There was also a meeting of NATO heads of government in the same week, which also included President Biden in Brussels, and the key strategic decisions took place there. And because you might think some of the tenor of my remarks has been somewhat critical of Boris Johnson, and my good friend Anthony Buckley told me that I needed to be very even-handed in my remarks, can I just say that the role of the British state, led by the Prime Minister in the Ukraine crisis, I think has been nearly exemplary. We have, leaving aside what happened in the run-up with Russian oligarchs and the failure to take proper defensive measures in respect of the Russian state, since the existential threat materialised in the invasion of Ukraine, and indeed some weeks before, Britain has done what it's always been good at doing in these situations, which is the harnessing of hard power and many elements of soft power, of which the BBC, of which I've also been a critic in the past, has been utterly exemplary. It is extraordinary that the future of the BBC should be in jeopardy, just as it's become the beacon of hope and light and truth across Europe. We have played an exemplary role in the resistance to Putin. We have been very much a leader of Europe in that respect. And as I think more broadly and reflectively about Britain's relationship with Europe, it's fair to say that we withdrew essentially from the leadership of half of Europe. We withdrew from the leadership of the economic side of Europe. We never withdrew from the leadership of the military and strategic side of Europe. Indeed, it's very notable that the most ardent champions of Brexit never sought to take Britain out of NATO, even though Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, which commits all members to common defence and stipulates that an attack on one is an attack on all, is a much, much greater pooling of sovereignty and implicit pledge of decision-making in advance than anything in the Treaty of Rome or any of the European treaties. And that has come to the fore not only in what's taking place in Ukraine, but in the exemplary leadership which Britain has played across the eastern frontier of the European Union. There are 10,000 NATO troops, a substantial proportion of them British in Estonia at the moment, and across the Baltic states. There are significant deployments in Poland, and it is very, very notable that there has been no infringement by Putin across a NATO border in all of the catastrophes of the last 14 years. So we have got some things right. We should celebrate what we do effectively and build on it. And as we do that, I believe we can play our part as we must in the collective leadership and security of our continent in the next generation, as we have in the last.
Just picking up on that last point, we had the Ukrainian ambassador here in the Abbey laying a wreath on the Innocent Victims Memorial just outside the West doors. And afterwards, he told me how startled and how delighted he was that the UK had been such a crucial partner in this crisis. We never looked to the UK. We never expected this. It's very moving to hear him say that. Lord Adonis, thank you. You have given me personally pause. I will think deeply about the way this Abbey Church and churches in general commit to this task. We gathered a group of mediators here about 10 days ago. It was a fascinating conversation, people working very hard to cross some of the divisions. I think what was noticeable in that was that they were all counting the cost of that and saying it is probably more difficult than it's been. And I note your point, your beginning, that peace comes at an extreme cost. And perhaps one of the things we need to think about is our readiness to pay that cost. You've given us a wonderful, memorable evening, wide-ranging, deeply informed, passionate in delivery, and also so deeply attentive to Eric Abbott. The questions are testimony to the way you've engaged all of us, and I'm sorry if you didn't get a chance to ask your question. You may not have noticed, but as you spoke more and more passionately about peace by a trick of the light, you were being bathed more and more generously in light. It was really quite startling. So from all of us, a heartfelt thanks. I want to thank my colleagues in the Abbey, Ellen and Claire and her colleagues from King's who made this possible. Thank you all for coming, but most of all, Lord Adonis, thank you for an extraordinary evening.
Every day.